Well, we're in a series. If you've been with us for the last few weeks, you know this. We're in a series on the life of David called Chasing the Heart of God. And in these first few weeks, we've seen the lives of David and Saul sort of intersecting, these two kings, one who is on the throne, one who has just been anointed as king. Last week, we looked at that famous story of David and Goliath, and this week, left on my truck, was a gift from one of our elders. It's a can of Green Giant green beans. And on the back, it says, "Too puny from Doug." So some of you will, if you were here last week, know what that's all about. This will be a cherished gift, Dave. Going on my shelf to be remembered. Well, if you have a Bible with you, would you take it at this time and turn to 1 Samuel chapter 18. 1 Samuel chapter 18. If you don't have a Bible with you, our ushers are coming down the aisle. They have Bibles. They can put one in your hand if you'll just sort of wave at them and let them know. And if you don't have a Bible at home, and need one, you can feel free to take this one with you. 1 Samuel 18 through 20 is what we're going to be looking at. It's a large section, and I'm going to need to really kind of fly through this. But these three chapters are basically a royal psycho thriller. It's a crazy story. We've got this deranged King Saul, who attempts to kill his enemy David at least seven times, depending on how you count. And in his attempts to kill David, he brings David into the palace where he can keep tabs on him and maybe find the right opportunity to do him in. When that fails, he brings David even into the family, marrying off one of his daughters to him in order to keep even closer tabs on him, really using her as a trap for David. When that fails, he orders a hit on him while his daughter and son, Saul's daughter and son, who love David, we see that they protect him and watch out for him. This is one really, really crazy story. And as I said, we're gonna tackle a big chunk of this this morning. So hang on. Here we go. As chapter 18 opens, we see the beginning of a deep friendship forming. Verse 1 of chapter 18 says, "When David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan and David became bound together in close friendship. Jonathan loved David as much as he did his own life." So in the last part of chapter 17, we have Saul and David in this conversation about killing Goliath, and we're not told everything that happens in that conversation, but something about it causes Jonathan to just immediately like this guy, David. The ESV translation puts it this way: "As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul." This was an immediate, fast, kindred spirit kind of a friendship that ignited here in the first verse. Jonathan and David were both mighty warriors. We know that. They both loved God. We know that. Jonathan feared God and wanted to obey God. And their friendship was immediately a covenantal one, calling on God even to bind them together. Verse 3 says, "Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as much as himself. Then Jonathan removed the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his military tunic, his sword, his bow, and his belt." So not only was this a covenantal relationship, it was a sacrificial one. Somehow, we're not sure how, Jonathan knew that God had determined that David was going to be the next king. Now, Jonathan was the crown prince, right? The throne was rightfully him after his father Saul, but Jonathan here surrenders his right to the throne in this symbolic act of giving David his royal robe, his military tunic, his sword, his bow, and his belt. I skipped over verse 2. Let's go back and pick that up real quick. Saul kept David with him from that day on and did not let him return to his father's house. Remember, he initially was traveling back and forth. He'd be in the palace playing his guitar for Saul, and then he would go back to tend sheep back and forth. But 1 Samuel 14:52 says that whenever Saul noticed any strong or brave man, he took him, just forced military draft, we'll call it, okay? Took him into his service. This was Saul's practice. So it's not surprising that after seeing David's bravery in fighting Goliath, Saul would enlist David into his service, and that's what he's done. Verse 5 tells us that David was successful at whatever Saul gave him to do, and that this pleased Saul. And so he promoted David to the rank of commander over his troops. And both the troops and the officers loved David. At this point, things are going pretty well for David, this shepherd turned soldier who was also secretly, we know, anointed king. And then we come to verse 6. As the troops were coming back when David was returning from killing the Philistine, that is Goliath, the women came out from all the cities of Israel to meet King Saul, singing and dancing with tambourines, with shouts of joy, and with three-stringed instruments. And as they celebrated, the women sang, "Saul has killed his thousands, but David his tens of thousands." Now, most commentaries say that there's nothing particularly comparative or disrespecting of Saul in this song. It's pretty common in Hebrew poetry for the second line to restate what the first line has said. So many Bible scholars just say this is the equivalent of the women saying, "Saul and David have killed our enemies. Yay!" Right? But Saul doesn't take it that way. Verse 8 says that Saul was furious and resented this song. "They credited tens of thousands to David," he complained, "but they only credited me with thousands. What more can he have but the kingdom?" So Saul watched David jealously from that day forward. Saul was furious about this song. Basically, he says he's won the hearts of all the women. What next? The whole kingdom? And then verse 9 says that he was jealous of David from that day forward. And this jealousy is going to grow in Saul. We need to watch this. This is what unchecked jealousy does in a person. It grows. J.D. Greer, in his commentary, says this: "Jealousy is a terrible emotion. Jealousy is a hunger you simply cannot satisfy. The more you eat, the emptier you feel, and then it forces you to feed it once again. Jealousy is like a drug that slowly kills you. It persists and pounds you until you are pushed to the point of no return. Jealousy is a terrible and harsh master." And so jealousy has been added now to Saul's emotional instability that we've already been told is due to this bad spirit or evil spirit, something that appears anyway to be God's judgment on Saul for turning his back on God. And then in verses 10 and 11, Saul's jealousy escalates for the first time into attempted murder. Verse 10, "The next day, an evil spirit sent from God took control of Saul, and he began to rave inside the palace. David was playing the lyre or guitar as usual, but Saul was holding a spear, and he threw it, thinking, 'I'll pin David to the wall.' But David got away from him twice." Some of your translations might say that Saul prophesied The word used here is literally a frenzied, ecstatic, and excessive rambling. There are times in the Bible, and we're gonna look at one of these, that the Bible speaks of such ecstatic vocalization when the Holy Spirit, God's Spirit, comes on someone. But this clearly is not that. This is an evil spirit. This is not one of those incidents. And this is why many of the translations choose to use the word raving instead of prophesying. We generally associate prophesying with something coming from God. And so the translation I'm using says raving. Well, at any rate, Saul throws his spear, trying to pin David to the wall. And it appears that he did it twice because David escapes twice. So we have murder attempt number one. So you might just count as we go along here. Verse 12 through 14 tell us that Saul was afraid of David. So we've added fear to jealousy. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with David but had left Saul. It's interesting here that Saul hasn't lost all sense of reality because he rightly assesses that the Lord was with David and that the Lord had left him. And so added to this dangerous emotion of jealousy, Saul is now afraid of David. We've gone from jealousy to fear, sort of a paranoia. And so he sends him into battle as the commander of over 1,000 troops. And because the Lord is with David, he continues to be successful in everything he does. Verse 15 tells us that the progression of Saul's condition has now moved from jealousy to fear to dread. We're getting darker and darker here with Saul. But verse 16 says, all Israel and Judah loved David because he was the one leading them out to battle and back. So just notice, in verse 1, Jonathan loves David. In verse 5, the troops love David. In verses 6 and 7, the women all love David. And now all of Israel and Judah love this guy, David. And with every one of those, Saul grows more and more jealous and afraid. Saul's growing jealousy and paranoia drive him to devise another plan to kill David. Verse 17, Saul told David, here is my oldest daughter, Merab. I'll give her to you as a wife, if you will be a warrior for me and fight the Lord's battles. But Saul was really thinking, my hand doesn't need to be against him. Let the hand of the Philistines be against him. So at first glance, the first part of verse 17, it looks like Saul is maybe just making good on his promise to give his daughter in marriage to the man who slays Goliath. Remember, that was part of the reward that was promised. But then we see that's not really the case. A couple of things that we see. First, Saul's condition on this deal, I'll give you my daughter if, is that David will be put in the position of warrior. Now, he had been made a commander over 1,000, and some Bible scholars think that this is actually a demotion to warrior from commander. Basically, Saul saying, I'll give you my daughter if you'll go to the front lines as an infantryman. And then the narrator tells us what Saul's really thinking. I'll get the Philistines to kill him so I don't have to. That'll look better for me, right? And verse 19 tells us that when it came time for him to be married to Saul's daughter, Saul changed his mind and gave her to another man. It seems pretty clear Saul had no intention of making David his son-in-law. And then in verse 20, somebody else falls in love with David. Now, Saul's daughter, Michal, loved David. And when they told Saul about this, it pleased him. Aw. That's so sweet. Saul's so happy that his daughter has fallen in love with David, right? Not so quick. Verse 21, Saul said, I will give her to him so that she may become a snare to him, so the hand of the Philistines may be against him. So Saul said to David, today is the second chance for you to become my son-in-law. What a gift, right? David responds by saying he's just a poor, common man, implying that he would have nothing to offer as the bride price for Michal. Some Bible scholars think that this also suggests that Saul had not followed through with his promise of the reward of wealth to the man who would kill Goliath. Because if he had, David would be wealthy, not poor, right? And because he's so very accommodating, Saul says, no problem that you're poor. All I want for the bride price is 100 Philistine foreskins. And then verse 25 tells us that again, Saul thinks David will die at the hands of the Philistines trying to fulfill this assignment. Well, Saul gets foiled again, right? Because David and his men go out and kill 200 Philistines and bring their private parts back in a bag, okay? And Saul has no choice but to allow the wedding. So now, if you're keeping score, we're now at the third failed murder attempt by Saul. And verse 29 tells us that Saul is even more afraid of David, more paranoid, because he realizes that the Lord is with David. And while Saul, I think this is important to note, while Saul sees David as his enemy, what's really going on here is that Saul has become an enemy of the Lord. That's really who he's fighting against here. And that's always dangerous business. That will never end well for us. Okay? So as we turn the page into chapter 19, we see that Saul is no longer trying to be sneaky about killing David. He's ordered his son and his servants to kill David. Sort of like Don Corleone in The Godfather. He wants the family to make sure that David swims with the fishes, right? And this slide from jealousy to anger to hatred is often that way. It becomes in us less private and more careless. The reason is what's in our hearts leaks out. Right? That's true of all of us. What's in our heart leaks out. Our true colors eventually show. Eventually they will show. They say that blood is thicker than water, and that may be true a lot of the times, but not for Jonathan. Jonathan has made this covenant with David, a covenant made before God. And so Jonathan tells David what Saul's plan is, that he wants to kill him. And this seems like something that David would have, you know, it's like, you think? You know, after four attempts now, you know, you think? So after warning David, Jonathan goes and tries to talk some sense into his father. Verses 4 and 5 tell us that Jonathan talks to his dad on David's behalf. Jonathan calls it like he sees it. He tells his dad, this is wrong. This is sin. Don't do it. He reminds Saul of David's bravery. He reminds Saul that David was actually of great benefit to him. He reminds Saul, maybe most importantly, that God was in this. And he says to Saul, you saw it. You rejoiced in this. Don't do this evil thing you're planning. Jonathan was a godly man. He was a good friend. And he was a good son. You know, sometimes it's the younger that teaches the older. Oftentimes it's the older that teaches the younger, but sometimes it's the younger that teach the older. Sometimes dads need their sons to say, Dad, don't do this. This is a bad idea. This is wrong. Stop it. If you're a son here today and you see your dad behaving foolishly or sinfully, step up. Call him on it. If you're a dad here today, do what Saul did, at least here, and listen. It seems here that Jonathan's words get through to Saul. Verse 6 tells us that he listened, which is more than just hearing. Saul heard and he acted on it. He swore an oath to God saying, David will not be killed, I promise. So Jonathan goes back and tells David that it's safe to come back into the palace, and David does, and he continues to lead Israel's armies into many battles and victories against the Philistines, and continues to play his guitar for Saul whenever Saul's in a bad mood, and it usually seems to help. And we're not sure how much time has passed between Saul's oath in verse 6 that he won't do anything to harm David, how much time between that and his fifth attempt on David's life in verse 10. But it seems that he had either forgotten his oath or was in such a dark place that, again, he didn't care. Because in verse 10, we read that while David was playing music for Saul, Saul tried to nail David to the wall with a spear. But he escaped from Saul's presence, and the spear drove into the wall. But David escaped quickly into the night. The sixth attempt on David's life seems to follow right on the heels of the fifth, because the very next verse says Saul sent agents to David's house to watch for him and kill him in the morning. But his wife Michal warned David, if you don't escape tonight, you will be dead tomorrow. So she lowered David from the window and he fled and escaped. Then Michal took the household idol, put it on the bed, put some goat hair on its head and covered it with a garment. When Saul's agents went to seize David, Michal said, he's sick. Saul sent the agents back to see David and said, bring him on his bed so I can kill him. When the messengers arrived, to their surprise, the household idol was on the bed with some goat hair on its head. Now, we got to ask, why in the world do David and Michal have an idol in their house? Anyone else asking that question? This is weird. The Hebrew word for idol here is teraphim. Teraphim. It only shows up a few times in the Bible. Rachel, you may remember, stole her father's household idol, his teraphim, when she and Jacob were escaping from Laban. Michal has one that we read about here. Rachel's was hidden under her saddle. You may remember that story. Michal's seems to be like life-size, right? King Josiah outlawed teraphim in 2 Kings, but then they show up again in the book of Hosea. And then the prophet Zechariah denounces the use of these teraphim because they lead people astray. There really doesn't seem to be any good explanation for why David and Michal have one of these in their house. Most of the commentaries that I read this week say that these were common items in the homes of ancient Middle Eastern people. It's like, what? That's not a good answer. I feel like the commentators are almost saying, everybody does it. Of course, in this story, this is used as a ruse to help save David's life, but I think it would be wrong for us to justify it based on that, because I think God could have and would have used another way of protecting David and getting him out of there. And I think it should give us all pause to consider what kinds of idols maybe we have in our lives just because everybody does it. It might be what you watch. It might be what you spend your money on, your time on, just because everybody does it. Anyway, well, when Saul finds out, he throws a fit, really, because his own daughter has betrayed him. And in response, she lies, saying that David threatened to kill her if she didn't help him escape. And once again, Saul's sixth murder attempt is foiled. When David escapes out the window that night, he runs to find sanctuary with Samuel in Ramah. It's 2.5 hours away. Bible scholars describe it as sort of a monastery that Samuel had for young prophets. Saul hears that this is where David has fled to, and he sends more secret agents after him. We assume this is for the purpose of bringing him back so Saul could kill him. And what transpires here is this really comical series of foiled attempts. So verse 20 tells us that when Saul's agents get there, Samuel and his group of prophets are prophesying. And then God's Spirit comes on the agents as well, and they begin prophesying. Now, this is the same ecstatic rambling we saw earlier, only this time it's caused by the Holy Spirit coming on them. And the result is they don't seize David. David escapes. Verse 21 says that when they reported this to Saul, he sent another group of agents. But the same thing happened to them. Then Saul sends a third group of agents, and they are also overcome by God's Spirit. So what's a guy to do? Go yourself, right? So finally, Saul goes himself, and the same thing happens to him. Except verse 24 says that in his ecstatic state, Saul took off his clothes and laid naked all day and all night that way. And the chapter ends with the people in the town making fun of him, saying, "So, Saul's a prophet now." Right? Friends, I got to tell you, there's some things in the Bible I just don't understand. This is a weird story. I don't know why God's Spirit would compel Saul to do this. Unless maybe it was just to further humiliate him in his determination to oppose God. It may just be that. At any rate, the end result is that David escapes with a day and a half lead on Saul and his agents. And then, as our story reaches its climax in chapter 20, we have one more attempted murder. Except this time, Saul attempts to kill his own son, Jonathan. And maybe even more importantly, chapter 20 sort of bookends for us these three chapters that we've looked at with a closer look at Jonathan and David's covenant friendship. So beginning at verse 1, David fled from Naoth in Ramah and came to Jonathan and asked, "What have I done? What did I do wrong? How have I sinned against your father so that he wants to take my life?" Jonathan said to him, "No, you won't die. Listen, my father doesn't do anything, great or small, without telling me. So why would he hide this matter from me? This can't be true." Jonathan seems to be holding out hope that his father, whom I'm sure he loves, surely he's going to come around. Surely he's going to come to his senses. David believes otherwise. Verse 3, David said, "Your father certainly knows that you have come to look favorably on me. He has said, 'Jonathan must know of this, or else he would be grieved.' David also swore, 'As surely as the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, there is but a step between me and death.' And Jonathan said to David, 'Whatever you say, I will do for you.'" David believes Saul is being cautious about what he shares with Jonathan because he knows that they are friends, even best friends. And Jonathan says, "Tell me what you want me to do. Tell me what you want me to do, and I'll do it." Jonathan, remember, has already figured out that David is to be the next king. His loyalties are with David, not his dad. "David, tell me what you want me to do." So David and Jonathan devise this plan to find out what Saul's intentions really are. David seems to already know, but it appears that he wants Jonathan to be as convinced as he is. And so they come up with this plan, which includes David being at this feast, this new moon feast that he would have been expected to be at. And the plan is that David actually won't show up, and Jonathan will see how his dad reacts. If Saul's okay with David being absent, maybe he's calmed down. Maybe things are okay. Maybe he doesn't really intend to kill him. But if Saul throws a fit, they'll know he intends to kill David. And they work out a plan for how Jonathan can communicate the outcome of this to David. And in the middle of this conversation, Jonathan and David renew their covenant to each other as friends. Look at verse 14. Jonathan said, "While I am still alive, extend to me the loyalty of the Lord, or else I will die. Don't ever cut off your loyalty to my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth and called David's enemies to account." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, and Jonathan had David reaffirm his oath out of love for him, because he loved him as he loved himself. And this covenant here will come into play much later when, after Jonathan dies, David adopts his son Mephibosheth. We've looked at that story before. David adopts Mephibosheth into his own family. And David remains faithful to Jonathan's family long after Jonathan was gone. So then, back to this feast that David is supposed to be at. Verse 24, at the new moon, the king sat down to eat the meal. He sat at his usual place on the seat by the wall. Safe place. You can tell what's going on in the room, right? Jonathan sat facing him, and Abner took his place beside Saul. But David's place was empty. Saul did not say anything that day because he thought, something unexpected has happened. He must be ceremonially unclean. Yes, that's it. He's unclean. However, the day after the new moon, the second day of the feast, David's place was still empty. And Saul asked his son Jonathan, "Why didn't Jesse's son come to the meal either yesterday or today?" Jonathan answered, "David asked for my permission to go to Bethlehem. He said, 'Please let me go because our clan is holding a sacrifice in the town and my brother has told me I need to be there. So now, if you are pleased with me, let me go so I can see my brothers.'" Jonathan says that's why he didn't come to the king's table. Then Saul became angry with Jonathan and shouted, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman." This sounds to me like a scene out of a Monty Python sketch for the Ministry of Insults, right? But I need to tell you that Bible translators, they know that's not what is said here, but they have chosen to sort of sanitize the language here, because the language is extremely vulgar, and our modern day son of a blank is mild compared to what Saul actually says to Jonathan. And then he continues, "I know that you're siding with Jesse's son to your own shame and to the disgrace of your mother. Every day Jesse's son lives on earth, you and your kingship are not secure. Now send for him and bring him to me. He deserves to die." Well, it's pretty clear now what Saul's intentions are, right? 32, Jonathan answered his father back, "Why is he to be killed? What has he done?" Then Saul threw his spear at Jonathan to kill him. So he knew that his father was determined to kill David. He got up from the table in fierce anger and did not eat any of the food the second day of the new moon, for he was grieved because of his father's shameful behavior toward David. So Saul's rage has now turned inward on his own family. This drug of jealousy and hate has now made his own family the enemy. And I was thinking, you know, it's really easy for us to see this, for instance, in substance abuse. We can see how the family pays the price for that addiction, right? But we're not always quick to recognize it with things like jealousy and rage, anger. We're blind to maybe some of these more subtle addictions. What I'm hoping is that you can feel the weight this morning of just how sad this story is, just how far Saul has fallen. Well, the story continues that Jonathan went out to the field the next morning where he and David had arranged for this signal with some arrows. And after the signal was given, David came out of hiding and he bowed down to Jonathan three times. And it says they wept and they hugged and they exchanged the Middle Eastern greeting of kissing each other. They recommitted their chesed. I've talked about that word, this stubborn, faithful kindness, love for one another. And in the last verse of chapter 20, we read, Jonathan then said to David, "Go, in the assurance the two of us pledged in the name of the Lord when we said, 'The Lord will be a witness between you and me and between my offspring and your offspring forever.'" Then David left, and Jonathan went back into the city. I've gone long this morning, and I apologize. But let me quickly share three things that I think we need to take away from this story. First, it's really hard to miss the consequences of jealousy and fear of someone else's receiving more glory than we do. Obviously, added in here are the repeated statements that God's Spirit had left Saul and this bad or evil spirit had overtaken him. That's definitely in play here. But the progression of Saul's love for David, chapter 16, 21, says that he loved him. The progression from that to jealousy in 18, verse 9, to fear in 18, verse 12, to hatred and scheming murder attempts through these three chapters should give us pause. Because left unchecked, these emotions will work against God's plan and may even destroy us like they destroyed Saul. Our emotions are a gift from God. They really are. They are like the warning lights on the dashboard of your car. They tell us that something is going on. And left unchecked, the problem gets worse. When those warning lights light up, we should pay attention. So what I see from this story is that when you feel that tinge of jealousy, and who of us haven't ever felt that, right? At some time in our life, when you sense that, understand this is a warning of a heart problem that I need to address. I need to take care of this because if I don't, it's going to get worse. It's going to lead to stronger, more destructive emotions that eventually will be acted out on. That's the first thing. The second thing, I think David's response is worth noting. David never picks up a spear. Gene Edwards has written a wonderful little book. It's an easy read. It's called A Tale of Three Kings. I've read it a number of times. I highly, highly recommend this book. In it, Edwards looks at Saul, David, and Absalom. And he identifies three prevailing traits that serve as warnings for us today. Saul's main trait is that he's a spear thrower. He's a king. He's a leader who attacks those close to him. Anyone know leaders like that? And Edwards points out that David never throws a spear back, and that we often do. Even when attacked, throwing spears back is not the way of a person whose heart is after God's own heart. I grew up hearing my dad say, "I don't get mad, I get even." It was a joke, I know. But that's not okay. Getting even is not the way of a Christ follower. God protected David. David didn't have to fight back for himself. He dodged. He dodged the spear. He ran away, yeah. But he didn't throw spears back. And if we're not careful, there's a Saul in all of us waiting in the wings to pick up a spear and hurl it at someone. Don't be a spear thrower. The third thing is, there's just this wonderful and powerful lesson about friendship for us to learn from in these chapters. And I'm gonna be using a lot of Eugene Peterson's, not a lot, I'm almost done here. Most of what I'm about to say comes from Eugene Peterson, who notes that the interwoven throughout this murderous plotting is the extraordinary friendship between David and Jonathan. So in the middle of the craziness and madness, the meanness and the hate, David experienced a most unusual love in Jonathan's friendship. The friendship and love that opens and closes the story, bracketed and contained the evil. Let me say that again. The friendship and love that opens and closes this story, brackets and contains the evil. Peterson goes on to say, friendship is a much underestimated aspect of spirituality. It's every bit as significant as prayer and fasting. Like the sacramental use of water and bread and wine, friendship takes what's common in human experience and turns it into something holy. Ah, I love that. Friendship takes what's common in our lives and turns it into something sacramental, something holy. Peterson says that friendship with David complicated Jonathan's life enormously. He risked losing his father's favor and willingly sacrificed his own royal future. But neither the risk nor the loss deterred him. He became and stayed David's friend. And Jonathan's friendship was essential to David's life. Peterson says it's highly unlikely that David could have persisted in serving Saul without the friendship of Jonathan. Jonathan had this ability to discern God in David. He comprehended the danger and difficulty of his anointing and made this covenantal friendship with him. And then I love how he says this. Jonathan's friendship entered David's soul in a way that Saul's hatred never did. Jonathan's friendship entered David's soul in a way that Saul's hatred never did. I think that's beautiful. Friendship does that. It enters your soul. Whether you are the friend who never really sees anything in return, that was Jonathan's case. He was one of those friends that didn't really get anything back. It was just a lot of loss for him. Being a friend to David was just a lot of loss. Right? Or maybe you're the friend who receives the most from the relationship. Either way, godly friendships shape you in deep ways. So be a friend to somebody. Be a friend to somebody. Maybe it's your spouse. There are spouses who are each other's best friend. I think... Yeah. Good. Or maybe it's a man-to-man friendship or a woman-to-woman friendship. A friendship that allows your souls to be knit together where you can know and be known by another person. And of course, the most important friendship any of us have is the friendship that we have with God. Proverbs 18:24 says that there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother, right? And when we get to the New Testament, we learn that Jesus is called a friend of sinners. That's you and me. That's you and me. So as the worship team comes to lead us in one more song, I just want to ask you this question. Do you know him? Do you know that friend of sinners? Do you know Jesus? Is your trust in him? Because friends, with Jesus as your friend, really, you can face any spear any Saul will throw at you. You can.